And she said, they did take my grandmother's leg when she was in the hospital. And I thought, oh my God, all I did was hold the intention to be supportive, right, of a person that was contacting me. And then this information that was kind of vital came.
Elaine Clayton is my guest. The Way of the Empath, How Compassion, Empathy, and Intuition Can Heal Your World. If you know you're an empath, feeling other people's emotions can sometimes be a bit overwhelming. So Elaine offers some helpful tips on how to get in touch with that, how to notice synchronicities that are giving you information about your environment, also how to use stream drawing as an intuitive process. I'll let her give you the backstory.
I can tell you how I realized something that I thought, wow, when I realized this, you know how when we have a problem or we're suffering, it seems like so hard to get the answer, you know, like we have to do this and do that. And it's like finding our way can seem so complicated, or something about our culture makes it feel that way. And I was briefly being, I'm an intuitive, you know, psychic reader, and I was briefly with a few different groups. One was California Psychics, but I didn't really like that. That wasn't really for me, because I like to spend more time and everything. So all I knew was someone was about to call me, because they would tell you, you know, and you would set up the time. And I didn't know who it was, but I was in my studio and I closed my eyes and just drew on into my sketchbook. And I was holding a sort of prayer for the person that I knew was about to call me. You know, I was thinking in my heart, how can I best serve this person? And I looked down and saw this, you know, what you would call a scribble. And I start to see into this image, you know, intuitively. I'm an artist, so you show me anything and I'll see faces, and I'm a figurative artist, so I see people and things. So that's not unusual. You know, if you have developed an artistic vision, you just do your thing when you see visual stimuli, you know, becomes whatever, you know, for you. And so I saw what looked like to me like a grandmother laying in bed. Maybe it looked like a hospital bed, because I started to realize there were all these like tubes and lines and really like an IV and maybe something to help her breathe. But she only had one leg. And I thought, wow, this is something. And I wrote all these notes. And when the call came a few moments, you know, while I was into this reverie, she called and I said, well, you know, I'm an artist as well as an intuitive. Can I tell you what happened when I was meditating for you before the phone call? Can I just describe it to you? And she was really sweet and said yes. And I told her, you know, I see this grandmother in the hospital. But I thought, how am I going to say this odd thing about the one leg? But I did. I said, but she only has one leg. And there was just this pause. And she said, they did take my grandmother's leg when she was in the hospital. And I thought, oh my God, all I did was hold the intention to be supportive, right, of a person that was contacting me. And then this information that was kind of vital came, and we were able to talk a bit about, like, there was something in the energy dynamic, the blessing, the gift, a mediumship message, you know, the presence of her grandmother, her whatever it was, all these things. But all I did was have the intention and use a creative meditation method that I didn't know about, because I just made it up, right? So I realized I went into a stream of consciousness flow. So it's like being in a dream state, but you're awake. And we can enter into that just by daydreaming, you know, by gazing out the window and things. So I realized that there was this phenomenal thing where you could use drawing as an intuitive tool. And I wondered if anyone else knew about it. I thought, someone has to know how easy this is. There was nothing out there. And I did come across Dr. Henry Reed, who did similar work, extremely important intuitive work. And I dedicated a chapter to him in The Way of the Empath. He was the only one that I thought was similar in that he was doing dream work with people and discovering how intuitive and psychic we can be through dreaming for each other. So I was able to contact him. But there was nothing out there. Simon and Schuster, published that book, Making Marks, Discover the Art of Intuitive Drawing. And it really was kind of one of the first things out there in terms of drawing as a specific intuitive tool. So I don't know if that gives you enough of a background, you know, but it's how stream drawing came to be.
Well, there's so many things in this book, in The Way of the Empath, and you're talking, again, here's the subtitle, How Compassion, Empathy, and Intuition Can Heal Your World. You're talking about different abilities as you think or as you meditate. You're describing that connection we all have in consciousness, that we are intuitively connected, whether we know it or not. And you're giving yourself an avenue to open up the understanding or awareness of what's actually happening instead of blocking it like most of us have been trained and taught to do.
Well, you make such a good point there because you're right. You know, we're so conditioned. Just it's an American culture thing. I think other ancient practices from around the world, and including Native American, of course, you know, I'm talking specifically when I say this about my experience as an American, you know, and we kind of are young as a country and we're really go get them, you know, we love youth and strength and all that. And so we were really raised on some good things, you know, how to get there, get out there and make things happen. And so it's task oriented.
Yeah.
So if you're not on task and you're a little bit overwhelmed or being initiated by your own psyche to be open to the phenomenal dream that you just had, that no way could you ever deny that dream because it's so impressive. And we've all had those dreams where we wake up and say, oh my God, I'm so glad it was only a dream. Or we say, oh my, I got to fly. I was flying, you know, or I saw you in my dream. And this is what we did. You know, they cannot be denied. Yet there was nowhere for us to put all that. We would march to school and you better be on top of it because you're about to be humiliated if you're not. So I think our culture really didn't value creative expression or intuitive knowing. That's a huge part of our intelligence. They left imagination behind. It's like we had to become little, you know, mathy scientist people, and that was the only thing they valued. Not, I'm being a little extreme, but I felt that way. I felt that way, so I'm maybe exaggerating.
We have something in common, because when I think or when I'm focused on something, sometimes I will look up and out and away, and I will do what it appears to someone else, absolutely nothing. But in my mind, I'm seeking, I'm searching, I'm imagining. And that's where we get in trouble. Because as children, when they are actually doing something, trying to come up with an idea or a concept and being shut down, saying, you're wasting time, you're daydreaming, you're not paying attention. And that isn't the way our minds work, is that we constantly do. There's break time that is necessary to function.
And open, yes, and that's so important too. And it's almost as though they emphasize only one type of learner when there are several types of, you know, learning dispositions, predispositions. Like we're just all wired uniquely, and so some of us did learn through daydreaming. I was definitely that kid. Plus, I could see the auras, and I didn't know everyone else didn't see that. Most people. No one ever talked about it. I just assumed, but that meant that I was, and I addressed this in The Way of the Empath, that for the empathic child, and I didn't really dedicate probably enough, there could be a whole tome, and there may be really good books out there on children who are empathic and how they are different. So I only went into it a little bit, but so if you're an empathic child, and for example, like me seeing the aura, that soft glow of colored light around the teacher, perfect background, a blackboard, you know, now it might be a whiteboard, but you see things very well when there's a neutral background. That light was so shimmery and interesting and compelling. So I'm taking in that plus the emotions of the people around me and their tensions and their feelings. And so, you know, I mean, that, why did we ignore that someone might be really having an emotional difficulty? We were encouraged just to shut that off for the agenda, And the agenda was worthy because learning empowers us. So I'm not putting down learning. It's just that I hope we can become more broad about how we approach learning and the ways in which we understand it. Because you, I can just see you while you were describing, I could see you being looking at the paper, you know, mm-hmm. looking up, giving yourself space to open, almost like mentally opening portals to get there, to yeah. have a way to access the information.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you could get in trouble. You could have lost recess for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or art, they would say, you can't go to art today.
I mean,
you're going to be eating by yourself. It's so important for us to realize that we are each unique and we're a miracle. Every person is a physiological miracle, you know, animated by this spiritual force of light, you know, the light in our eyes just says so much. And if we try to appreciate that first, I think we get places, you know.
Chapter 2, Dreams, Signs, and Synchronicity. This is a way I think anybody could pay attention to whatever intuitive message they're getting.
Dreams, signs, and synchronicities. Oh my gosh, I just live for these things. So when you dream, so we are precognitive. You know, we do get signals and we are amazed when it happens. You know, and it may not be that often. But when it happens, you know, when you've dreamed a scene, and you might not have even remembered the dream, but throughout the day or a few days later even, something happens and it activates the memory of, oh my gosh, I dreamed that. I remember dreaming once when I was teaching in Boston, and it was about it was this really magical dream about a red-winged blackbird. Excuse me. And so I was just in this kind of place about this dream about the red-winged blackbird. And then the dream kind of shifted. And a teacher that taught across the hall, and she was from India, wonderful person, in the dream, the last part of the dream, I passed by her in the hallway. And she said to me, "Oh, Elaine, I have these tights. They don't fit me. I feel that they would be better for you." And she hands me these, you know, legging kind of things, tights, whatever. So the next morning, I go down the hallway. That exact scene unfolds. Dela came up to me and said that exact thing. "I have these tights. They didn't fit me. I want you to have them." I'm just completely in shock. Then I go into the classroom, you know, teaching these adorable 5-year-olds. And this girl comes up to me with her parent, and she has a little white box in her hand. And she says, "I have this for you. I found this for you." And I said, "What is it? Let me see." And I opened it up. And I guess, you know, what's inside. It was the feather of a red-winged blackbird. So you could say, well, what does it even mean? You know, I don't know what it meant. It meant that we're all connected, that when we're in the astral plane, you know, the place where we rejuvenate, our bodies are rejuvenating when we sleep, and our minds offer up a lot psychologically. And some of that stuff also is, I think, spiritual exploration. Like the dreams are multidimensional, so they can be analyzed in so many different ways. You know, Freud or Jung or however, I love to say, what did the dream feel like? Sometimes the scenes give us precognition. And when it happens, I don't really need to know why. I just love that it happens. Now, I will say this doesn't mean that really scary dreams always happen. Sometimes something really scary does happen, you know, in life, right? And usually even the dream is kind of worse feeling than the actual thing itself when it does. But, you know, so I don't want to say, oh, every nightmare we have will come true or anything. I think the dreams that are usually the most psychic and on some level happen right before the hypnagogic state. So the dreams I have right before I wake up, when I'm floating in that ether before you open your eyes, but you're consciously aware,
Yeah.
You can have a lucid dream anytime while you're sleeping. But I don't know if you find that too for you, that the most psychic dreams are really in that time before you wake up.
For me, I think that's because there's more emotion triggered at that time. It's bringing that out of it, I wake up with a wow, because I'm ready to act upon it and integrate or transmute whatever mm-hmm. information I just got. That to me seems like a powerful time too. So, you know, I don't know.
I agree.
Recently, I had a dream about a friend who's deceased. And in the dream, I'm like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. She called me on the phone in the dream. And I'm mm-hmm. like, wow, how are you? It's so great to hear from you. We were worried. Okay. She's deceased. All right. So, mm-hmm. but you know, it's, and she's saying it's great. It's fine. What are you doing? I'm working on some spirituality things, which makes perfect sense. And well, that's excellent. And, something else happened in that where there's this connection. And I realized right before she died, about 2 or 3 months, she called up out of the blue and said, is there anything you need? And I was thinking, good grief, that was odd. And I said, no, not that I can think of. She said, when you do, I will be there. I will have it for you. And so
that's so beautiful.
Well,
I got the chills.
It was mm-hmm. it was a signal. And she used to go to the boats and gamble, all right? She just, that was one thing she loved to do, and she didn't have high income. This was, for her, an escape. And we bought a ticket, and we won $500.
Oh, that's so fun.
So that was just recent. But right after the dream from her, and I thought, okay, all right, there she was.
Well, she visited you. That was a mediumship visit. And yeah. I want to say something, and this ties into the synchronistic thing. I think they come through, spiritually, for some reason, I don't know exactly why it is, but you know how we are affected by electricity. We're kind of conduits mm-hmm. of electricity, our
yes.
bodies. And I think that the spirit realm can communicate through electricity. You know, you'll hear people say, I went into a house, I felt like it was haunted, the lights started flickering. Things can happen, you know. But I do think a mediumship event happened in your dream, and it's really only for you to say what it meant, but if you don't mind,
I'll
say it triggered a thought for me, which was that it's a double message, like I'm here, and the dream was itself, you know, her presence with you, and it was showing you there's a tool in which I may come through. And what is that? You know, through communication tools that you use mm-hmm. in your, you know. So what happened with me, the reason why I became super aware of this, I had heard people tell me about this before when their mother died or whatever. And, you know, so over the years I was curious about it, and I have mediumship dreams and experience, especially when I'm working with clients and somebody wants to come through. But I tell you, my mother, when she died, and this sounds so zany, but it's so amazing. I was having a really hard time around the time that she died because of some personal stuff. You know, life happens and mm-hmm. she died. And so it felt like an overwhelming time. And I was texting my sister and I said to her all these emotional stuff, you know, oh, this is hard, this is hard, and this is hard. And she was trying to help me. And I said, you know, I have to put the phone down because I have to give my younger son, I have to give him dinner. So I'll be back. So that was the last thing I texted. I'll be right back. Put the phone down, gave my son his dinner. When I went back to the phone, in the text box, as if I had texted it myself but hadn't sent it yet, were the words, I am so sorry. I didn't text that. I texted what I did and put the phone down. I knew immediately by feeling, I had a rush of feeling that it was my mother mm-hmm. coming through and saying a message that I'm so sorry you're hurting,
yeah.
you know, what a mother would say.
Uh-huh.
So then guess what happened again this past Mother's Day? There are some things that signify my mother. So if I see them or hear them, it's a sign from my mother. So one of them, she was from Kansas, you know, Missouri and Kansas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And She briefly knew Judy Garland because she was at Austin Riggs Hospital in Massachusetts. She worked there when Liza Minnelli was a baby. So when Judy Garland was there, she would make phone calls to check on the baby Eliza. So mm-hmm. she had this connection and fascination with Judy. She just loved Judy. Mm-hmm. So when we watched The Wizard of Oz when we were little, my mother kind of blended with Judy, you know, because we could picture what my mother's life might have been like when she was young. It was like this, you know, girl out on her farm. And so when we hear Over the Rainbow, it's my mother's song, and we sang it at her funeral. Well, on Mother's Day morning, one of my little sisters said, she went to her cell phone, and same thing as it happened to me before, as if she had texted, but this is even more complex. It was as if while she was sleeping, her phone decided to go through Apple Music, select a song, put it in her text message system, you know, uh-huh. and ready to send. And it was the Hawaiian version The Isaac. So I was just talking to my other sister about that a few days before, saying that is my favorite version. Mm-hmm. But my other sister had said, well, that wasn't Mom's favorite. She liked Judy's version only. And I said, well, but it's my favorite. And so there it was, Israel, you know, Israel's version. And my sister said, I don't use Apple Music. I don't think I own that song even on it. I mean, it's not even in my register of knowledge. How could my phone have gone to Apple Music, selected that of all the thousands of songs, and then pretended that I was texting it to you? So we laughed. We knew that was from my mother.
Absolutely. When your heart knows that you're connected, the mind doesn't have to deal with it. The heart just says, yeah, hey, Mom, thanks.
Let it be a gift. Let it be a gift. Why would we disown a synchronicity like that? Why would we rationalize that as silly or ridiculous? I love being rational. If there's a rational reason why the cell phone can do that, then bring it on. But it doesn't remove the magic in it anyway, even if we did do that. You know, I think we have a reluctance to accept a spiritual connection, period. We want to deny it.
It's out of our control. So there's a part of it that says everything's supposed to be organized and everything's supposed to make sense and be linear. But these kinds of things aren't. And so when we can't connect the dots of how this is possible, then it's like, well, it's a mistake, it's an accident, it's impossible. Instead of saying, anything can happen. We just don't know how.
That is so true. You said it, because the ego does seek to control. We do have to be responsible, and there are some things that we learn to control. We learn very young, and our body requires it. We have motor control. We develop skills. We love to, a dancer has to learn to have some control. But a dancer also knows it's not just the mechanical control. It's the spirit with which she moves, that, you know, the motivation, the inspiration. If there's no inspiration, there's no artistry. So why we would deny the spiritual aspect that comes through us, that isn't really about our control, is, I think, fear. Because you're right, the ego does want to dominate and control and to have the answers, and the ego really doesn't even want us to release control ever. But that's how we suffer a lot. I mean, we learn a lot through it, and we suffer a lot through it.
And I think a lot of that's learning, especially all the things that we're going through right now on the world stage, where everything is incredibly chaotic. And that can be scary, and it can be disempowering. You feel vulnerable. If, well, anything can happen, and I'm at risk. Instead of doing that, it's anything can happen and I will deal with it. There's a difference in between being victimized and being charged with your own personal power, however it comes to you, developing that and beginning to act on that. That's what this challenge is all about. It's saying, okay, everything around you is going to go topsy-turvy, upheaval. And how do you engage that inner knowing, that insight, that second sight? And that's what you write There are some things in this book I think are really helpful, especially around the issue of protection when you're dealing with people who are not empathic or sensitive. And how do you deal with that? Because that's what is around us right now, people who are not in touch with their intuition and scared to death.
So we have all these different eras in life, stages of maturation. You know, when we're first developing our identity, ego is real strong in certain ways then, and you know, then we reach other points. So we are buzzing around, each of us at our own point. And sometimes someone may be living their whole life, let's say, not as very intuitive, but they're fulfilling a role that we don't understand that may benefit someone else in a way that, again, we don't understand. I mean, I think there's a lot of mystery with the way in which we are alive here. So I can't always know. And I'd have a reluctance to want to judge someone who isn't particularly intuitive in their, you know, manner or in their orientation.
Yeah.
However,
yeah.
for me, and, you know, from what you're saying too, do I want to be around that very much? Because I'm sensitive. How does it feel for me if I'm exposed too much to people who really don't want to hear me be myself or want to deny a spiritual presence or are adverse to it? You know, we have to get away from what is toxic for us. So how do you do that? Well, I guess that's a lifelong learning, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
You start to, yeah. I mean, you go, it's trial by fire. Empaths always have stories of, oh, I got pulled into that and I got pulled into that. Because when your heart is open, you really don't sense a separation. Your heart just races forward before you're there. It's like your spiritual oneness is felt. And it's not, it's real. You feel it. But the problem is, the ego sometimes, I think, the ego often says, oh, I feel it, I care, I must be the one to have to fix it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then you get involved in things. And this is where I believe I've learned the most, to just ask God, how can I, and this is how I do it, I'm not trying to tell anyone, I'm not evangelizing, I'm just saying, I will turn inward and ask God, what is the best way for me to be helpful? And I had a Cherokee mentor for years, and she would say, you know, if you ask God, God puts stuff in front of you in a way that you will not doubt. You will know that there's a role for you.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times the best thing you can do is just carry the light within you, be present for whatever is healthy for you, and then you send love out. You don't have to be involved in everything. You can do actions that make a difference. I also don't say it's someone else's problem, God will fix it. We do that too much too sometimes. Sometimes we have to roll up our sleeves and get involved.
Mm-hmm.
But it's up to us, each of us, to know what is the way in which it's best for me to do that. You know, like, so for me, one of the ways might be, you know, making this spiritual artwork and writing these books. That might be what's best, the best way for me. Now, if everything, let's say we're in Ukraine, no one, you know, we're running past, artwork is, doesn't matter. It's about life. It's about saving lives instantly, immediately, you know? So our circumstances can also tell us what is best to do, you know, how best to serve. So it fluctuates, but, I only know from myself how to figure out through trial and error what feels most harmonious and beneficial for myself and others, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's through time we discover this, that through, time is a gift in that way.
Yeah, through time and experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to dealing with someone who is not as empathic or sensitive or aware on that level, the goal isn't to avoid. The goal is to, in some way, shape, or form, come to some sort of an agreement or a truce even, to know that when I need a mechanic, the mechanic doesn't have to know about his chakras, okay, or her chakras. I need a mm-hmm. mechanic who knows the engine. And the mechanic mm-hmm. may not want to hear about me waxing on about astrology. So I'm going to deal with the mechanic in a way that will benefit both of us and allow that we are different people. We have different strengths. We have different abilities, and we need all of the abilities, because that person may need me to get them in a different space right before they're doing something else that could cause more problems. And me making that phone call just did a service. I don't have to have credit. I don't get acknowledgement. I just know I was there at a time that was important, and I'll hear about it later.
That's so true. And you know what? I believe, and I have felt that the more mature, I guess, I mean, and again, I say through hard lessons, embodying a feeling of love, feeling of light, and just being around, going somewhere with that embodiment, that's the energy that the presence to me, that is the presence. So as best it can come through me, let's say, or through you, just doing that. We don't have to always do anything. Just be in that love position, you know, where you feel it. And then others feel it. It doesn't have to be explained. But, you know, it's so fun. I love how you describe the mechanic, because sometimes that's the exact guy that says the most awesome spiritual stuff, you know. Or the doctor, you know. Like, for a doctor, personally, I want someone empathic, because I think the energy of their love toward healing heals me better than something mechanical. Yet we will also say, you really, okay, the most gruff surgeon, he may not seem empathic at all, but he changes people's lives by what he does, he or she, by what they do. And they, in that way, are fulfilling something extremely empathic, because it enhances people's ability to function.
The Way of the Empath, How Compassion, Empathy, and Intuition Can Heal Your World. ElaineClayton.com. Elaine Clayton is my guest.
I started to realize drawing people, you know, like just going around drawing and painting and seeing people in their environment. You can be walking and looking like the most miserable thing and feeling miserable. God, why aren't you helping me? And you have this glorious tree arching overhead. It's like we are in a stage set where everything is a prop. And sometimes it feels like a really bad junior high play that we're in, and it's awful. And then sometimes we realize everything around us is here for us. It's a prop to support us as we're on our way. It is magical. And it's brief. We're not here that long, you know?
No. Okay, here's another one. My husband and I were out at the lake and walking the dogs. And all of a sudden he says to me, I'm looking the other way, thinking about something. And he says, a bird in the water, not a water bird. And so, and I don't even see where the bird is. But immediately it's like, uh-oh. So we run to the house and get, there's a kayak. And then he points out where the bird is. So I get in the kayak, go out and get the bird ASAP. I sit with the bird for about a half an hour, 45 minutes, just sitting and sending love. And I know the birds, he saw the other birds trying to get this bird out of the water, picking it up and dropping it. It's a grackle. It's for anybody who needs.
Oh my God. I saw that picture and the color of that bird, the blue in that grackle.
Oh, yes.
And you got to be with that grackle in that grackle. Yeah. Oh my God. It was so beautiful that you saved that beautiful bird.
But I wouldn't have seen him. I was looking the other way. And then he's saying at one point when we're getting the boat out real quick, as quick as we could, that he's saying, I don't think he's there anymore. And I saw a movement. I'm like, I don't care if he's not there. If he's not there, he will know that I tried. And the other birds that are around there will know that we tried. We were not going to give up. And
So beautiful. So, and the bird seemed to really know, didn't he?
Oh, it was so cool. And he was extremely quiet, dripping, and he needed to be warmed up because the water was still cold. And I just trusted and then sent the energy and said, it's okay to come back, you know, knowing that however it turned out, this was the way it was supposed to play out. Within moments, I felt him kind of do a little shake, a quiver in my hand, and then flew and up to the nest. And then we saw him come back later on in the day to the feeder with the little tufts where he'd been tried to, you know, plucked from the water. It was just amazing because I didn't know. It's just, I knew with Reiki, hoping that he hadn't been underwater too long because he'd been there.
Oh,
for
it's so beautiful.
While.
Oh my gosh.
But that if my husband had not been there was my point. I would not have seen it. I was not looking that direction. And he had seen the whole thing play out. Others who are like us, who are with us, are there are tendrils, there are tentacles. They reach out for us and draw us into situations that we might need to be in, but we wouldn't be unless these others who are around us are here saying, hey, jump in.
There was just no question. No. You're going.
No,
and so we know when it feels right. Sometimes it's complex and, you know, we have all these situations that are kind of complex, but I think we do generally know it. And by the way, this is a whole messy process. So we're going to have a lot of things happen that aren't comfortable and that we don't get the clarity, you know, and you don't always get to resolve something with someone else or
the bird might have died. And then the question was it wasted? Mm-hmm. And in that regard, I would have said no, because everything there in that moment, everything present would have seen and observed that there was someone who cared. So
it makes me think of the peaceable kingdom. I mean, animals still eat animals and, you know, something has to be sacrificed for us to survive at this point, you know, in this human existence. But at the same time, you can see examples of the lines fading, like the veil thinning, where that oneness that I talked about, you know, we talked about earlier, really is everything, oneness with everything. And, you know, so the animals are part of that. And I feel like that bird is your bird. I mean, that bird, you know, the Native American animal medicine, whatever animal you encounter is bringing its gift to you. So sometimes someone, you know, I mean, you could be attacked by a bear. That's not good. What's a gift in that? But if the natives taught that, you know, you would look and see what was it bear gave me. Bear mm-hmm. did give me a spiritual gift of some kind.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it'd be fun for you to study what people have said over the centuries about grackles and what their gift is.
Yeah. As I was rescuing the bird, thinking, you're going to be afraid of me and you have nothing to fear.
Because, he didn't look afraid in the picture. He looked like he knew exactly that he was being helped.
Yeah, he'd been in my hand for about at least half an hour at that point, And so,
he was being helped and he knew it. Yeah. It just looked that way.
I've had an experience before where I rescued a frog from the middle of a swimming pool. No way for the frog to get out. When I got the frog, I picked the frog up and put him out, and I knew that there was a message in this scenario. And the message from that one was, and I sat him beside me, and he stayed there probably 10 minutes to dry off. The whole area dried off around us from being wet. And I asked if he had a message for me. Looking directly at me, the frog said, "Don't be afraid to accept help from unconventional sources." And so find yourself in a crisis of your own making, don't be afraid to accept help from unconventional sources. And so I was thinking about that, thinking, even though I would be a predator and be very, very scary to this bird, that I needed to remember that if I sent the energy of have no fear, I'm harmless, you know, that I thought.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there's that message of sometimes help comes in a way that we don't anticipate, and we project our own fear on there when it's unnecessary, and trying to remember if I'm in a situation where I need help, to trust that whatever has come for me will have my best interest at heart, and just to trust, you know, that. Because that's what mm-hmm. calmed the bird when I was just sending nothing.
Well, I think that's a perfect example of empathic living, because it's being in a flow, in a state of allowing, not braced up, not in resistance, but in an open allowing of time and space and yourself in it, and trusting that open-heartedness, open, expansive kind of expectancy that things will come, mm-hmm. you know, but they're not a threat, makes the walk be not about, you know, whatever's in my head and I got to get things done and so-and-so better stop annoying me and whatever we do when we're on a walk sometimes if we're not in an allowing kind of spiritual disposition. And here you are with your partner and you're walking along and you are in a receptive disposition and we're able to act. So that's empathic living. That's being in the flow. That's when they say you're in the flow, you know, and or in the zone. You can be in the zone all day long, even when you're doing things that require, you know, you could do your taxes, but you're still in that zone. It takes time, I think, to develop it. And, of course, there are times when, again, we need to protect ourselves, but we know that then that's just another message that comes. You get a wariness or a sense of, I need to be wary here. But that's empathic living, and it's a beautiful story.
Earlier, you were talking about getting that image, and with the stream drawing, it opens up a wide avenue of potential, just getting something on paper and saying, what might this mean? How can I express this?
Yes. Now, this is using drawing as an expression of the most essential thing about us as humans, and that is we are creators. We are born creating. Just the fact that we exist is creative because it changes everything. A baby being born changes the dynamics vastly. It's a presence of life that suddenly has gestures, decisions, you know, choices. This is the sages say everyone is a Torah. And I even had that in my dream last night, talking to someone about every person is a Torah, a whole story of the presence of God, basically, and the struggle with understanding what God is. But every soul here alive as a human is an active creator, whether we accept it or not. And what happens is very early on, we discourage our connect, you know, like people freak out because the kid drew on the wall, but that was the most exciting thing that kid did. There was this blank space and I can change it. And without thinking, drawing all over, and then it becomes labeled a scribble. Oh my God, you're in trouble. You know, don't do that. Well, of course, and I think every home should have a wall or a section of a wall where kids can do that. But the reason why is that just we're mark makers. You know, the cave people knew that, hey, look what happens. I make a mark, you know, and then it tells a story almost immediately. There's a lot of emotion inside one single mark made. So, yeah, I'm a professional artist. I do spiritual figurative work, children's books, books for adults. I did all the art in this, The Way of the Empath, in a specific empathic sort of style. You know, I sort of knew to do it differently from other ways I've illustrated books in the past. But this is using drawing as a reaffirmation of ourselves as creators and as a way to get people back into that realization that they have empowerment there as creators, because it's simple and it's innate and you can do it. And so with this method, and it doesn't matter whether we call things art or not, that's just beside the point. We are artwork ourselves. Each of us is a work of art, ready to create, ready to decide, to use our free will in some way to have an impact. We have an impact on the world, whether we like it or not. It's just, what kind do you want to have? And so when you close your eyes and use your non-dominant hand, you really do draw that way. It's free. You can't, you're using your non-dominant hand, so you don't have a lot of control, so you don't hesitate. Because you're right, I found out years ago, I started this in the mid-1980s, because I saw that adults and kids, after they reach a certain age, they usually feel braced up and afraid of rejection. They're afraid to commit a mark on paper. And so they don't want to, you know, they'll say, I like to draw, but I don't do it because I'm not good at it. So if you draw with your non-dominant hand with your eyes closed as a creative meditation method, what does that do? It gets you creative. You don't have to decide what your hobby is. All you have to do is just go into this little daydream of expression. And then gazing at it, you can begin to have a relationship to the marks that you made that are spiritual and intuitive sort of components. There's a reflection. There's an intuitive conversation that happens. So, and then you go from there. So I really encourage people. I mean, I teach it, and I always include it in anything I'm writing now, because I think that it's so essential for us to not cut ourselves off from being creators. I mean, I'll ask people often, what do you love? And they'll say, oh, I don't know. Well, you know, I think if we don't lose track of or lose that essence of what we love, we're happier. But we get so busy and so burdened with things that we're supposed to do that forgetting what we love is really easy. But I think if we spent just a little bit of time doing this creative meditation drawing, you know, it reinforces that you're a creator. And then maybe if you reflect a little and just get into that feeling that feels good, we start to remember what we love. You know, the mystic Edgar Cayce said that our ideals are so important and essential. And so we each idealize something a little different. You know, like my ideal thing is I love horses. And I could just tell you all about why. And then the minute that I start going into that, I'm already one with what I love. I feel the love. I feel excited. I feel vibrancy. You know, that's like the spirit within me lights up. So we just, though, really more so train each other to be in a state of lack where our conversation is more like, yeah, I love horses, but, you know, I don't have one and probably never going to get one again. You know, and we start on this long tale of how we don't have the thing we love, and then we separate ourselves further from it. But if we remain aware that we are what we love and find a little bit of time to be creative, so we get into that zone where we nurture the part that we love and nurture the creator self, I think so much good comes out of that.
What I like on your website, you have your journal, your dream journal, sketchbook journal, and there's various examples of different types of drawing. Some, you know, looks like it was a part diary and then a dream drawing. These are the various ways you can express yourself. It doesn't have to be a fine art portrait. It can just be doodles.
Well, and I don't even call them doodles. You know why?
Why?
Because I think that on one hand, the word doodle makes us feel playful. Oh, mm-hmm. It's a doodle. I can not have pressure on me. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when we would draw and they would call it a doodle, it was like they were acting like it was a silly, stupid thing. And yet it's this profound thing. People go into all kinds of amazing imagination realms when they draw, especially when we're young. So I call it stream drawing because, like it or not, if you start drawing while you're listening, while you're on the phone, while you're at the meeting, whatever, you're compelled to make a mark at that moment for some reason. Yeah. And something profound is underway. So I like to honor it and change the way our culture perceives it. And I don't really love the words like scribble and doodle and whatever, because it usually is kind of, and I'm not trying to say we can't use those words. I'm just saying it can convey non-importance, insignificant. Mm-hmm. You're wasting my time. You're wasting your time, you know, et cetera.
Mine are special. I've never disowned my discounted my doodles.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You knew, though. You knew you were in a reverie. Yes. An intuitive, spiritual thing was happening.
These are kids, okay? And they each have a different personality. And that was a funny thing about doing the interview with you the first time, when making marks. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've got all these things I've been drawing for years, and I never really put the two together that I was actually saying something that that told a story.
Yeah, and you don't have to interpret it. I mean, and the story part happens just because the form, the line, and the shapes do talk. Mm-hmm. But we don't have to analyze ourselves, you know, our marks all the time, or do anything with them but enjoy drawing them. We don't have to do more than just drawing them. And that space we've opened is in itself a fullness. It is a fully realized beautiful thing, just that by itself.
Yeah.
The part where it can be wonderful if you want to is then letting those lines, shapes, and forms talk to you intuitively. Because they do, because we're visual and they do evoke an emotion. So let's say I'm minding my own business, walking down the street, and there's a zigzag line on the sidewalk. It might startle me for a second or catch my attention. Whether I acknowledge it consciously or not, that expression of that line enters me and tells me something. It's either a relaxed line or it's a jagged line. It has personality. Mm-hmm. So the most subtle line, I mean, think about when we were watching the teacher draw or write, you know, and the chalk would break and everyone would laugh, or she would he would accidentally press and the number would come out looking funny.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny.
Yeah.
Because the line work that conveys a certain thing they want us to only focus on suddenly became something else.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that these line shapes and colors speak to us, but our culture uses it mainly to create in us the need to buy something.
Right, commercial.
Commercial, buy it. You're not skinny enough. Your hair doesn't look good enough. You need this, you need that, you need, and I'm not anti-capitalist, but isn't it interesting that we use line shape, color, and form to snag each other, to profit off of each other, rather than realizing you can heal each other,
mm-hmm.
you can receive beautiful spiritual messages that will enhance your sense of actually you already have everything you need, and the other things are not an emergency. They're things you can acquire if you aspire to, or if you have a necessity physically or whatever, or if you're taking care of children and they need something. It doesn't have to be a fear-based thing, but those images that we put out there commercially are really, they spend a lot of time designing exactly what colors to use, exactly the layout that will ensnare us visually before we don't even have a chance to realize the impact it has. It just has it.
When you learn that there are marketing techniques being used, you start saying, I don't need to be exposed to all of the marketing.
Yeah, artistic vision and artistic education is essential if we want empowered people. We shouldn't be cutting it out. We shouldn't cut out any of the arts, because at least if I talk about how color, shape, form, and line have an impact on us, and I learn and I'm aware of the way our society and the whole world really uses that stuff to manipulate us, sometimes not positively, especially in a super capitalist environment, then I am not disempowered. I'm not a victim of it. I can discern. I can say, aha, yeah, good one. I see what you're doing, you know, but I'm going to decide if I want to even look at that. And, you know, like, for example, I don't even watch most TV. I don't like it. I don't like the stuff. I hate commercials. I can't, mm-hmm. it's gotta be awesome. Like, I have a student that, that does commercials, and her name's Amy Ferguson. She is a genius. So she does creative, imaginative, amazing stuff with a sense of humor that you can tell she knows that we know more. She's not insulting our intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, she's creatively almost getting us to love what she does through humor that says we're all in it together and it's playful. The other stuff can be just kind of condescending and we get duped, you know. And so I think that we're changing and evolving slowly, and people are less likely to fall for stunts, but I don't know. I mean, I think we do need to remember that this kind of visual expression is also a very important and essential spiritual avenue for us. And definitely you want to do something creative every day. You want to find something that makes your heart sing every day, even if you just do it briefly because you're so tired and busy, or you at least can say, I'm looking forward to doing it on Friday when I have time. But the reason why I recommend stream drawing is you can do it very quickly, and just for 5 seconds, even like under a minute, just get into that zone just a little bit, or use it during the day when you have a lot of extra tension or something, just to let it out. And then pull out some colors and use your favorite colors, because colors, we don't have to talk about it, but they speak to us and make us feel good.
All of that stuff, right now, there's so much stress and so much, we're being bombarded emotionally, physically, psychically, the whole thing right now. So one of the things that I think this brings to our attention is our ability to decompress. And this is an easy way to do that. And not only will you feel physically, mentally, and in some ways spiritually improved, you'll have a sense of well-being that it can extend to your community as well, where you won't feel so frazzled when somebody tries to call you and needs help, or when somebody cuts you off in traffic. They'll say, okay, that's their deal. That's not mine.
Exactly. It's a conscious awareness and checking in, centering. Yoga does it. A lot of practices do it. Just breathing, being aware of our breath, the breath of life that comes through us. That is so powerful. And the ancient people knew our breath was like God breathing through us. I mean, it's just very beautiful and important. A little bit of time is just to do that really does change everything. And on a last note, I would say just honoring that in ourselves helps us honor it in others. And we're less likely to unconsciously flip out, react. You know, we still do it. We're human. But we're more likely to really project love because we're giving more love to ourselves.
ElaineClayton.com, the book, The Way of the Empath, and you can get it at Amazon. On your journal page, what I see in that little stream drawing where it says stream draw your way to freedom is a happy, and it looks like almost like a unicorn riding a dinosaur.
Oh, awesome. You know what? I love it. I love it. And you know, when someone does a stream drawing, I just love saying, can I please comment on your stream drawing? And I will say this too, as another final note, if you do a stream drawing and you're having fun with your stream drawing, and this is a basic cardinal rule for us to respect each other, is I, like, for, let's say, Wendy, you invited me to look at your stream drawing. Mm-hmm. Well, you and I, we're going to see millions of things, right? And we can turn it and look and see all kinds of things. And when we invite each other, it's so beautiful. And I post those just for that reason, to invite people. And so I have to now go find what you saw. But I will say, like, when someone does a stream drawing, they feel like, we all feel vulnerable when we commit a mark to paper.
Yeah.
Because we're used to someone saying whatever they want to say. Usually it's criticism or judgy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The funniest one is when it looks like a banana, you know, and someone says, oh, I know it's on your mind, you know.
Yeah.
Or I felt like, you know, some people that really didn't read the Making Marks book, they just didn't really get what it was I was trying to convey. I came across this once. It was in a review, and I realized, and I didn't comment or anything, but I realized they didn't really get it, that it's not a tool to judge other people. You don't ask your ex-boyfriend to do a stream drawing so you can then look at it and say, oh yes, see, you are a psychopath. The point is, I don't judge yours, you don't judge mine, but we can share if we want. Yours is for you to interpret, just like it's a dream that only you can really interpret. You might ask someone to help you with it, but it's your dream. Same thing with drawing. And the reason why I say this is because people will stop drawing if they feel like everyone can tell them what's in their drawing. You know, oh, your drawing is this, your drawing is that, your drawing is that. But when we invite each other to do it, it's so much fun because you're gonna be in a trust place.
Okay.
And so I only say that just so that people know that please don't judge someone else's drawing. Let them tell you what it means, and don't judge don't let others just say things to you about yours, because I don't want it to shut down people's expression.
Let me add something else. Most of us are very, very self-involved. It isn't about being egocentric, narcissistic. It's about survival. And so no matter how we look at someone else, it comes through our filter. So my filter, when I'm saying, and it could be a mouse, a unicorn riding a dinosaur, tells you so much more about me than it does about
you. Yes, yes. Yeah. So that's just that exactly what I do say in Making Marks, that if someone does say, oh, it's a banana, and you're thinking of, you know what, then they saw the banana.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells you about them. It's ridiculous for us to do this to each other. I just know how much people will feel shut down if they feel their drawings are
judged,
kind of for others to judge.
Yeah.
And the thing is we only know the world through our own perception. So the joke is on us.
Mm-hmm.
Every single thing I perceive is about me.
Yep.
And my way of filtering it.
I'm exposing myself, damn it. I mean, darn it. I mean, shoot.
Yeah. This is great.
Well,
I'm so appreciative of you having me, and it's been just so enriching, and I feel so lucky and happy to have had this time.
Thank you. Well, I love your work. And I think it's, for me, it's joyful. It's fun. It gives, you know, another way to express ourselves without the feeling that it's supposed to measure up to some superficial standard. And that's where we excel and where we learn, where we grow, where we evolve. And we are free to be whoever it is we are.
Amen to that.
At the beginning of the show, I opened up with Elaine and her experience with a woman who had a grandmother who had one leg. Elaine didn't know that as she was drawing the picture that gave her that information. But that's an example of how stream drawing can give you inside information about your environment, about other people, about emotions, about all sorts of things, and to use it as a creative tool. ElaineClayton.com, that's the website. I'll post links in the description for the show, and I'll post the picture of the bird that I rescued from drowning on my website, and that's the WordPress blog site, TalkingToNightLights.com. I wasn't sure if the bird was going to live because he was incredibly cold and he didn't seem to have a whole lot of energy when I picked him up. But as I held him, like I said, for about half an hour to 45 minutes, he recovered, and I watched him just gradually and slowly come back to life. But the best thing was at the very end, when he made that very subtle movement, gathering his composure and flying from my hand. That was amazing. Thanks for listening.